Welcome back. This is Nathaniel from the Film Experience, and I'm here with Katie from Vanity Fair.
Hello.
Joe from The Atlantic.
Hi.
And Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks.
Boo!
We're going to talk about Nightcrawler, Pride, and Birdman today. So Pride has already come and gone from New York, which means that, Katie, you did not get to see it.
I know, and I've heard raves about it from Cannes, from people who wrote for me, saying you couldn't be able to resist its charms.
And that turned out to be true.
Yeah? It's really charming.
I mean, the poster has Dominic West and Imelda Staunton, like, dancing on a club, so I don't really see how you could not want to see that.
And that's actually, like, one of the worst scenes.
Really?
I think that's the only scene where it tips over into, like, oh, movie, you're trying too hard.
Well, there is also the other scene where Dominic West dances not unlike Susan Sarandon dancing about cancer. But you totally forgive it.
So it's the Elizabeth Town of gay pride movies? This is...
Oh, I was thinking Stepmom, but...
Oh, Stepmom, of course. No, what is she...
Interesting meme.
She tap dances in Elizabeth Town.
Right.
I'll never know.
Yeah, it's a different... there's a different purpose to it. Stepmom is the right call. But yeah, there's a... That was an odd scene. You're totally right. But I... Oh, God. The rest of that movie...
Amazing.
It's really, really touching and really... It's a generous movie. You know how much I love movies that are like... Take the time to give a lot of characters their due. Because it fits into a genre very sort of nicely. And that sort of British working class... you know, the unexpected humanity of such and such... You know, Billy Elliot, Full Monty, that kind of a genre. So it's not entirely unexpected what you're going to be getting, but this, I don't know, this whole concept of this mining town and this group of gay activists coming together, like, they really pull it off in an incredibly kind and touching and sort of muscular in terms of, like, politics kind of
way. Oh, yeah, yeah. And, like, that made me, like, Nick, your tweet about that actually addresses that about right. Donating to charity.
It encourages you to think about what you can do for people who are not technically you or who you think are not you. And then you think about it for 5 seconds and you realize how you actually are in the same predicament as those people.
Asking people to think outside themselves is like a no-no in cheap politics.
Completely. Yeah. Or even in even in many kinds of politics. And like, I remember that, do you remember that Velvet Goldmine ends with this one shot in a pub where the miners who are striking are sitting there having to drink beer by candlelight because the government has shut down their electricity because they're striking. And it's the same strike. It's 1984. Mm-hmm. And all the reviews were like, what does that have to do with gay anything? Like, nah. Here it is.
Here it is 16 years later. We got you.
So this is a sequel to Velvet Goldmine.
Mm-hmm. But it's funny how when you talk about the movies that this reminds us of, just that whole cycle from the 90s, you do see the tradition that this movie is working in, but it's also been like 15 or 20 years since they've really gone full bore at it. So it does feel kind of weirdly like a vintage throwback or something, even though I wasn't paying attention. I didn't notice that those movies had kind of stopped getting made.
Yeah, I mean, I think they still try them on occasion. Like, oh God, what was that? Made in Dagenham.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely that genre. But
wow, that was heroic. Came up with that.
It had Oscar buzz.
It sure did have Oscar buzz.
That's right.
That if either of those movies had opened in the 90s, they would have been hits.
Big hits.
I mean, but it did break a million, which is, you know, nowadays hard to do for tiny movies.
Yeah.
If we do anything for this movie via this podcast, just be incredibly rabid to see this the next time it's available in any possible fashion.
Yes, because it is really, not only is it charming, but it's also smart.
Oh, yeah. Like,
and it's weirdly balanced between a ton of characters, which is pretty rare in movies.
It's not really structured as, like, here are the 5 principal characters, and then these are the next 10, and then these are the next... Like,
right.
Kind of everybody is on screen almost all the time, and even people who have a pretty spotlighted role then are gone for important reasons for, like, 15 or 20 minutes at a time. But it kind of ends with telling you stuff about what happened in the futures of these people, and you realize you're interested in every single one of them. And
yep.
you,
yeah.
know them all really well. It's amazing.
And it doesn't pretend that its place in history is only about one thing.
Right.
Where, like, this is, you know, about a specific historical event with the miners' strike, and specifically this, because this is all based on a true story.
Mm-hmm.
But it allows the rest of what's happening in the world to seep in very realistic and not exploitive ways. Like,
yep.
They sort of touch on the fact that, like, HIV/AIDS is, like, an emerging thing, and you think that's just going to be, like, this sort of, like, oh, in passing, like, oh, right, yeah. and then you worry that you're going to make a big, huge deal of it and make it, like, sort of schlocky. And
yeah,
that
and
also
have
does
it
happen.
Steal the movie away. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's a very smart movie. I think you're right to say that.
And vis-a-vis the other movies we're going to talk about, it proves you can make a movie without having one guy in the middle of it being like, oh,
yes.
What if I did what I'm thinking about?
Yep.
Is that a segue to Birdman?
Sounded like it.
Or any, or Nightcrawler, or Foxcatcher, yeah. Or whatever. There is variety. Sometimes it's two or three men being like, oh.
Uh-huh.
And man, did I ever get...
a great point about that this week, too, about this. Is this the year of difficult men at the movies rather than on TV?
But well, that's and like when I every year at the movies.
Well, it feels like more than usual. But when I said that Whiplash was a straight boy movie, man, did I get some pushback. People did not like hearing that.
Well, listen.
But I guess who didn't like hearing that?
It's so true, though. It's so true.
Anyway, sorry. That's last week. Birdman.
I will be very interested in people's feminist recuperations of Whiplash. I can't wait for them.
Birdman.
Also a testosterone-y movie, despite the fact that it has a few well-delivered female performances, I think.
Yeah.
In fact, it could single-handedly solve Katie's supporting actress problem. It was like, nominate all five of them!
Wait, are there five? It's Andrew Riseborough, Naomi Watts, Emma Stone.
Amy Ryan. And Lindsay Duncan as...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There are five, yeah.
Theater criticism / movie criticism incarnate.
She's sitting in the only bar in Midtown I can tolerate, so I really support her choices.
Oh, the Edison Bar?
The Edison Bar is a great
Edison Bar.
Edison Bar
is 100% not next door to the St. James Theater, but it's okay.
There's even Merritt Weaver left over for Nathaniel's cameo category.
I saw her name in the credits, and I couldn't even figure out where she had been. I totally missed
it. She was the stage manager.
She was the stage manager.
Oh, and she's like half in shadow the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't Lubezki did not favor her. He didn't linger with his moving camera.
The thing about Birdman as compared to Whiplash is I definitely got much less of that aggressive, like, oh, macho decision making because there's so much going on for so much of it.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, it kind of gave itself over to the macho decision making of it. And I felt really bummed out by it. Like, mostly I just wanted Edward Norton to come back and, like, cause chaos.
I love him.
He's the machoist of the mach. He's so good.
So great.
He's this great agent of chaos in the movie that makes it feel kind of wilder for a long time until it kind of becomes something that felt a lot more standard despite the flying and telekinesis and all of that.
Yeah, and what's so great in his performance is that, like what you're saying with the agent of chaos, it feels like the character is very self-absorbed. That you could, in most circumstances, say the actor is like, it's a very egocentric performance, but I actually found it really generous.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really all, for the character, it's all about him, but he seems to sort of rile up all these instincts in the other actors.
Mm-hmm.
Since you're actually seeing them share scenes, which is my favorite thing about the movie, because I'm always complaining about that you don't really get that in movies.
Yeah, because it's the not camera's like a
always,
shot.
Yeah, the camera's always, it's almost never two shots, it's always one shots, and
oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, and so it's like really fun to see like three, you know, see three people in a frame or or more, and then see, you know, you can choose where to look, which is always exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that scene of him and Emma Stone on the rooftop, for as much as I feel like the writing maybe sort of settles down into something kind of standard and traditional, like just being able to sort of watch the two of them play off each other in that wider shot was really nice.
Or all
the Phantom of the Opera marquee in the background, which for a movie that doesn't get subtle very well, I think that's a nice sort of, it's this big, giant, prominent Phantom of the Opera mask, but it's never commented upon, and I like that.
I liked all the scenes, both with Edward Norton and then the guy who he replaces in the play, all the rehearsal scenes at that table on the stage where it just
Jeremy Sheamus, yeah,
and I liked all of those, just the way that like the way they're all bouncing off of each other, kind of like regular theater.
Mm-hmm. So you guys are going to participate in this conspiracy to make me think that was not Chris Kattan, that was some other person. I saw it the second time and only then noticed that it was not Chris Kattan. All of my notes are like, CK then says, like, it just didn't occur to me that wasn't him.
I wish it had been Chris Kattan.
But yeah, like, I agree with Nathaniel. I really liked this movie, despite the seeming superciliousness of my segue. But, like, I really like it a lot. And then I went the second time and liked it even more. But yeah, that sense that you can put any two people in this movie together and get a good scene out of them is one of my favorite things about it also. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I thought that even scenes like, I mean, I take Joe's point about the Lindsay Duncan character, but I also felt like that scene was so set up to be the kind of scene where she, you know, hits a really good ball, but then he just destroys her back and the movie sort of chortles. But she so does not act devastated by his little tirade. Like, she's so bemused by the whole thing. And did think in a lot of ways the movie managed to not sort of pick sides as obviously as it seemed to be picking sides.
I don't know if I entirely agree with that scene specifically. I feel like that scene is 100% designed for us to sort of climb onto Riggin's bandwagon and sort of applaud, and there were people in my audience who did applaud and he sort of just like slams her down, and it's just like, and yes, she sort of, that character doesn't, you know, wither away and sort of slink away, but I still think that scene is 100% on his side.
I'm with Nick on this. I think her two scenes in the movie are a lot more elusive to their meaning than people are giving them credit for when they take offense to it, because in both scene, like, there is an element of Birdman that you can take each of the scenes as not completely true. Each interaction is sort of heightened by whichever character's point of view you're in, because, for example, when you first see the critic gets with Mike Shiner, Edward Norton, and it's a very different scene. And she's presented as sort of like a bastion of integrity in that scene, because it becomes like that, if I ever give you a bad performance, you know, because he's basically insulting her and she's still a fan of his.
I don't know if it respects her enough to call her a bastion of integrity.
Well, I mean, that might be that's overstating it. But my point is he treats her badly as well,
mm-hmm.
and she respects him. And he expects her to respect
well,
him
how
because
can she,
he thinks he does not give bad performances.
How can she help but respecting him, because she is but a lowly critic who is powerless but to respect a true artist? That's how I felt like I was coming out of that. Like, that's how much the deck was being stacked, that this character ultimately couldn't even make a good enough case against this virtuoso actor.
I feel like I'm between you guys. Like, the thing that bothered me most about the critic character is that it really seems to think that a critic would walk into something and being like, well, you don't belong in the theater, so I'm going to give your play a bad review, no matter what. Like, that's, like, no one would do that. No one who is a serious critic, especially the New York Times critic. And it really bugged me that that's what these guys think critics would ever do. And this is, like, obviously critics are going to hound on this character because we're all self-centered. But that part of it really felt dishonest to me. And it, like, no matter what, how much of it is fantasy, and I think how much of the movie is fantasy overall is an interesting thing to discuss. It kind of confused me. But that felt like a really ungenerous description of a character in a movie that has a lot of other wrinkles for its characters that seems to care about them.
Mm. I take your point.
Yeah, I mean, I take it too. I just didn't think we were meant to take everything that happened at face value in the movie. And
that's another thing that I walked out, that is kind of a broader question about how much of it we're supposed to take at face value.
And I just didn't feel like we were necessarily supposed to take any of it at face value, because some of it you have to make those leaps, those imaginative leaps or metaphoric leaps. Or, I don't know. I just think the movie is so rich that it's disappointing to me that critics are that fragile that they have to only talk about her.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I was sympathetic to her from the moment that it was like, these totally self-absorbed actors in two different ways, like, go next door and cannot help engaging her in conversation when they should leave her the fuck alone. Like, that she's withstanding that much narcissism that is so much more openly kind of wounded in Michael Keaton's case than Edward Norton's, but it's not like either one of them has the gumption to just not care what she's going to say.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I don't know if anybody else felt that, like, enjoyed how strangely mysterious the atmosphere was. Mm-hmm. Like, in addition to the sort of, like, the roaming camera and the no visible cuts thing, some of it seemed to, like, evaporate and sort of reappear. Like, the way people entered and exit scenes was just so, like, it felt so richly mysterious to me.
If this movie had literally anything to say, I would probably give it, like, an A+, you know, have it be my favorite movie of the year, be over the moon about it. Everything in terms of the visuals and the way it's acted and the way that sort of dreamlike atmosphere and nothing is quite real enough or fake enough. It's in this weird, like, middle ground, which I kind of love. I just thought it was such an empty shell of a movie when it comes to saying anything about anything, including the theater, including movies. I don't know. I found it a fraudulent, I guess, is maybe the closest that I can come in terms of, like, what it thinks it's accomplishing versus what it's actually accomplishing.
I want to hear Nick talk about, because Nick, I think you're the biggest fan of it I've talked to since I've seen it. Like, what do you say to Joe saying that it's fraudulent? Because obviously you don't think it is.
Well, I mean, I think Nathaniel might like it even more than I do. But I think that there is an aspect to it that maybe because it is so grandiose and doing this huge, hubristic, single shot thing. And I do think some of the writing, like, when I look at that credit with, like, the four screenwriters, I imagine that one of them I don't like. Whoever of them is sitting at the table being like, what if we made a joke about how she licked a homeless man's ass? Or, like, they're just, like, every once in a while you hear that someone around the table is, like, the unhelpful person who the other ones don't have the balls to just be like, you have to go. But, like, and there are moments where it does seem like maybe just sort of like a stunt. But I don't know. I do like it a lot. I felt like it was saying things. Like, I feel so, we are all so familiar with just the read on actors playing superheroes, just as an example, that is just about they're going for the money, or this is terrible because Hollywood only cares about one kind of audience member. But to actually think about whether the bigger toll of that is that even well-meaning actors internalize completely sort of hopeless expectations for their own success, or actually it does prove contagious that you start thinking of yourself in grandiose ways if you keep playing characters like that or thinking at that unsubtle scale. I kind of liked that about it. And then I assumed that theater was going to come across as the sort of nobler enterprise in which the well-intentioned really are trying to prove their artistic bona fides, but then theater also became a site of plenty of grandiosity and grandstanding, even though I thought the movie was actually kind of sympathetic to the theater and in some ways to movies. So I thought the argument it was having about those things actually got kind of subtler. And things that, well, whatever, I've said enough.
I mean, I liked all its little contradictions about those things as well. And it made me think a lot. And I saw it twice, like, within a week, and loved it even more the second time. Yeah, your point as to, like, it seems on the surface that it's like, oh, theater is more legit, and there's even conversations about how legit it is.
Right.
Like, obviously, the Naomi Watts character, I forget her name at this moment, Leslie, she is also an actor like Reagan, who does not feel legit. And so going to the stage is going to prove that, but then you have that SmackDown scene from Emma Stone where she just, like, this is a 60-year-old story and you're performing it to old people in New York who are thinking about what they're going to have for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does that make you relevant? And I thought that was, I thought, like, the argument about people's egos was way more complicated than just, oh, actors are self-absorbed.
Yes.
Like, not, well, it wasn't even arguing any specific thing. To me, it was more like a study of egotism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And all the different ways that it affects people and all the different ways they pretend they're not affected by it and the way they react to it in other people. I just thought it was super interesting.
And even just at the level of having a one-shot movie that's not actually happening in real time, like, as maybe everybody else got this before I did, but there were just a couple scenes in the beginning where it took me a second to understand that major time leaps were happening, even as the camera continually moved from one place to the other. That seemed gutsy, or at least I couldn't remember.
It's really exciting to watch it and to feel off balance the entire time, to not really know where they're going to take you or like how things, even until the very end. I think it ends on a note of uncertainty where you don't quite know what's real or what's happened or anything like that. I liked its willingness to keep you off guard. Like, it feels good to see a movie that's following a format you don't understand.
Yeah.
I really appreciated that about it. I can't decide which of you guys I agree with more. I think I guess the frustration had all these interesting things going on with this amazing ensemble, and then at the end of it just settled so heavily on Reagan and his point of view and his story, and I kind of wanted more of everybody else. You know, like, they have this great scene between Andrew Riseborough and Naomi Watts of them kind of comforting each other, and then it kind of goes in this very fascinating direction and then just quits. It doesn't really address them again.
The end of that scene bummed me out so hard.
Joe, did it bum you out because it seemed inevitable it would go there, or because it wasn't picked up later?
Because I kept, like, don't go there, don't go there, don't go there, don't go there. And it's, again, this, I don't know, I'm going to get people hating me this entire award season, but, like, it was such a male gaze kind of a scene for that end, where it's just, like, you know, you get these two female characters actually having a conversation and actually talking about things, and, like,
you're passing the Bechdel test.
Yeah, I thought about that, too. Right.
And then almost as if, like, a fuck you to, like, well, now that we passed the Bechdel test, we're going to have a make out for your jack-off pleasure. And I hated it. And that's the movie for me. It's just, like, things seem to be going along so well, and then something will happen, and I'll just be like, oh, right, I hate this guy behind the camera so much.
Oh, man.
I can totally see that. I mean, I really like the movie a lot, but even, I don't know, I felt like, you know, some movies you feel like, no, I'm going to prove to people that this is wonderful. Like, I can see how you would react in any number of ways to this. My version of the unpopular reaction is that I had a hard time enjoying Edward Norton in it, and Derek tells me that I'm just, like, you know, shrewhearted about Edward Norton, but there's just something about, I feel like he is so Kevin Spacey'd out at this point that he is constantly watching himself act and be like, it's pretty good, right? Isn't it pretty good what I'm doing here? That now that he's playing a character where it's supposed to be part of the fun to watch him kind of play with our perceptions of him or be an egomaniac, like, I can see that he's doing a good job, but it seems so similar to the way he's played so many other characters that did not invite that I just can't enjoy it anymore.
That is an interesting problem, because that is the whole purpose of casting him.
Of course, yeah. But it just feels like the boy who cried me, 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 or something. It's like, if you're always riffing on your own persona, then it just doesn't impress me when you, like, do it. But right. I see that he's good in it. I just can't.
So, Nick, what's
can't
your favorite?
Get it out for him would be one way to put it.
What's your favorite performance in it, then? Because I feel like there's so many to choose from.
Michael Keaton. Yeah. I think it's great. I thought, I was expecting the movie to be a little more, to have a slightly simpler idea or just rest with the parallels of his own career and this figure and have the whole movie just kind of come to him. But I felt like he was constantly just doing stuff and doing stuff and doing stuff in his scenes. And willing to make it more complicated than just feeling sorry for him, or and more complicated than just being excited that things start turning out. Like, I guess we won't talk about the actual end of the movie, but there's such a dark read of what has happened by the time everyone has been vortexed into his own sense of things, and watching him the way he wants to be watched. And I love the scenes with Amy Ryan.
Like, yeah.
He's amazing in close-up, which is not something I've ever necessarily thought about Michael Keaton.
Yeah. His face is really amazing to watch in this.
Yeah.
Because I don't know, he's aged in a fascinating way. Did you like anyone?
Oh, I liked a lot of people. I liked most of the performances. I thought Norton was phenomenal. I really loved Emma Stone. I loved Naomi Watts. I loved Michael Keaton. Like, I think the cast is almost uniformly very good. I think certain actors don't get served as well. I think Lindsay Duncan and Amy Ryan both, I feel like, are a little underserved. But I think everybody is actually, like, performing top-notch. I have no complaints about the cast whatsoever. Edward Norton's probably my top supporting actor performance this year so far. Mm-hmm. I wish I could get a little bit more on board with the Michael Keaton thing, and maybe that's he's the one that suffers most from my problems with the movie, just because he's so representative of the movie. But I mean, I'm thrilled that he's sort of getting this, you know, late wave of respect and this late chance to really bite into a role. That's great for him. I feel like if the pendulum is going to swing overly for him this year, I'm fine with that, because I feel like he's probably been, you know, fairly under-rewarded for his talents.
I hate to be the person who's like, I didn't know he had that in him, because I hate the effect that has on award season with various categories. But this is another reminder that actors are not challenged enough, and that there's too many roles and movies that don't give them anything to play with, because there are so many actors who surprise you when somebody hands them something meaty. And he, like, I just love him in this. And I've seen a lot of his movies, because, like, you know, I was going to movies during the 80s when he was cast all the time.
Right.
And he just never been this good. Like, even in things he was acclaimed for, like Clean and Sober. And maybe it's the whole, like, the fusion of theater and film that allows a lot of them to have these long scenes where you can see the...
Or Andrea Riseborough's previously unexplored capacity to be fun.
Like fun and sexy in weird ways, and yeah, she's so different in this than she is in her other things. Yeah.
I didn't even understand it was her until after a couple scenes that she'd been in, and then was thinking, I thought Andrea Riseborough. Wait, what?
Wait, is that the reputation we have for her? Is that she's the not fun one?
Yeah,
I mean, what has she been fun in?
Yeah, she's very serious in most movies.
And she dials that way up even in her interviews. Like,
thrown off by I saw her first in a play, and that's fucking me up. And that's always fucked me up with her.
Did you see her first in The Pride?
Yes.
Yeah, me too. And
with Hugh Dancy and with
Ben Whishaw.
And she's phenomenal in it, and she's a lot of fun, and she's very sort of bright and energetic. And
Nick, isn't that the play we saw in Chicago?
Yeah, the Derek dramaturg here. Yeah,
yeah, but not with Hugh Dancy.
Who did you guys?
You would have noticed that, and I would have told you.
Yeah. So I feel like because that was my starting point with her. Everything else has been, you know, oh, good for her that she's getting this little opportunity, and like sad for her that WE happened and
Oblivion.
Although she's super good,
she's great
in
Oblivion.
Movies.
I feel like
she's very good in both of those.
What's that?
She's good in both of those movies. It's just that the movies aren't good.
Yeah.
I feel like WE deep sixes her in a way that at least Oblivion allows her to rise above what else is going on.
Well, there was also the sort of joyless march of being Madonna's like self-consciously picked person for that month. Like, I'm all about her now. Okay, yeah. Let's be over. And
God, did that hot potato get dropped after that movie failed.
Well, that's kind of how it goes. And then you go have your meetings. But yeah, I just feel
and Debbie Mazar and Rosie O'Donnell go have a coffee together.
And Rupert Everett and yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, Google the famous interview of her that I think The Guardian did a couple years ago. Just like the levels of self-seriousness are astonishing. It was one of those things where you can just tell the interviewers like, nope, I'm not even going to help her. This is what she said to me over and over again. Which makes it sound like I have it in for her. I don't, but whatever.
I love her, but I have
it. I would not have imagined her for the Jennifer Tilly part. I'll just say that.
Yeah, I love her, but I will say that is kind of true. That is the way I have interviewed her, and she is very sort of serious about, you know, speaking about her craft and all that, which has its, you know, place and everything. But again, it was nice to see her throw a curveball with this.
Yeah.
Like that whole scene where, you know, she slaps him and you can't, she's ping-ponging from one emotion to the other and totally off-balancing him.
Yeah.
It was such a good scene.
That's a good scene. So we'll be talking about Birdman for months.
Yes.
Yeah, how well do we think... What are its chances in terms of, like, Oscar stuff?
I think it's gonna do really super well, because I think it's... they like theater movies about theater, and it's fun. And in addition to being fun, it has these these technical elements that are showy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's going to do really well. So, Nightcrawler. Very few. We don't have much time left. but that opened for Halloween, and I think it's interesting that they were trying to pass it off as horror. It is kind of scary, but more in like a internal, you know, way.
Listen, what Jake Gyllenhaal does to his face in that movie is horror enough. He looks so weirdly skeletal and scary and sunken in eyes and weird sweaty grossness.
I thought he and Rene Russo were so fantastic that I didn't even care whether or not the movie around them supported how fantastic they were.
That's a boon.
Yeah, because I when I left, I'm like, I don't know what the takeaway is, what I'm supposed to take away from that, but I
think the takeaway is media boo, scary.
You didn't like this one either, Joe?
I don't. This is another one of those movies that, like, is good. It was good to a point to me, and then it really started repeating itself and really like doubling down on all of its fairly shallow points. Mm-hmm. And it made me like it less and less until by the end I was just like, God, thank God it's over. But I was really liking it for a good like 45 minutes there. Gyllenhaal's really creepy. Rene Russo's awesome. The movie stops caring about her a good half hour before it ends at the very least. I think it makes some fairly basic points, but atmospherically it's pretty creepy. And yeah, I stopped caring towards the end.
How about you, Nick?
I might have come out around the same place that Joe's talking about, but I think it was a big up and down kind of all through for me. It didn't get gradually more on my nerves. I'm not that huge a fan of him in it. I like the whole concept of what he's trying to do in this movie and in general. Like, I feel like he keeps testing himself with pretty tough characters and with pretty interesting directors, but he just always seems like he's auditioning for some other kind of career to me. Like, it seemed very deliberate.
Yeah, the idea behind it is visible at all times.
Yeah. And that opening scene where he's interviewing, going, I would really like to work very hard for you and I will do everything you ask, seemed like Jake Gyllenhaal to me. Like, I would love to be your Oscar nominee. Like, okay, that's not totally how it works, but okay. But he's trying, and a lot of people don't try. I mean, I agree with Joe. Like, the points about the way we live now seemed not the reason to see the movie. And even some of its creepiness, I don't know. I admired it. It did push my buttons in ways that I could kind of respect, even though sometimes it pushed buttons in ways I didn't totally respect, I guess. It was interesting.
Mm-hmm. And you have not seen it, right, Katie?
No, I'm intrigued by it, and I think I thought it was scary and then was being a baby about it. But I saw Enemy earlier this year. Is that that's the one made by Denis Villeneuve? And I didn't like it that much at all, and I agree with the try-hardness of Jake Gyllenhaal. I mean, I really didn't like Prisoners, so this is kind of a residual thing going on, but you see him working so hard to be liked, and it seems like it plays into the character in Nightcrawler really well from what I understand, but
yeah.
I do have a hard time not just seeing him like begging to be taken seriously and having us all forget about Prince of Persia.
It's the Prince of Persia haunting him.
And the irony is, we've all long since forgotten about the Prince of Persia.
So. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's one of those movies that are like, that was a movie?
Yeah, that's a definite feels like it never happened kind of a movie.
Yeah. But he kind of constantly...
movie where the Prince of Persia walks behind him going, Jake, Jake.
He kind of constantly feels like the guy who, like, got overshadowed by Heath Ledger and then never really got over it in a way. Like, you know, he gave this, like, really good performance in a very acclaimed movie, but no one paid that much attention to him, and it's almost like he's trying to make up for it ever since.
I'm a huge fan of him, so I can't listen.
Oh, we're being too mean to Jake.
No, I mean, like, this try-hardness thing, it's a weird phenomenon that people are picking on people who try hard lately. Because it's, like, I started hearing that phrase that you used with Anne Hathaway during Les Mis, and it seems to be, like, a bugaboo with the internet right now.
But I don't think it's picking on him to say that I mean, as I said, I think it's great and that a lot of people don't try, but that's one thought. And then another thought is all the signs of the effort are just all over this performance to me. Like, we may disagree, but I don't...
No, I totally hear what you're saying, and I agree with it. And I would say that about Colin Farrell.
Mm-hmm.
That's often how I view Colin Farrell. It's like, I like that you're trying to push yourself.
I see DiCaprio that way a lot.
But I can see the effort. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying fully. I'm just a huge Gyllenhaal fan. So, like, it's a little hard for me to hear about him. And also because David Fincher was just so not nice about him. When the Zodiac experience was over.
Really?
Yeah.
And he just kept calling him too earnest. And I was just like, it's kind of in the structure of his movie and the goals of the character. I don't know what you were expecting. It's not like a light character or an effortless character.
Gyllenhaal is one of the people who got tortured by David Fincher and then like never claimed that it was like great in the end or anything right. like that. Like he was kind of open about how much it sucked.
So yeah, I'm just a little touchy on that situation because it seems like a lot of actors I really like get that same critique. But maybe it's because I really respond to actors who I sense are always, you know, checking their boundaries and whether or not they are still there.
Mm-hmm.
You know? What did I love that about Nicole Kidman, too. It's just like, she'll just try something, you know?
What did you guys think of the turn in the story where, in Nightcrawler, where Gyllenhaal and Rene Russo have this sort of twist in their relationship where Gyllenhaal wants to, like, coerce her into having sex with him. Which felt, like, creepy in a way that was off topic.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It just felt like an unnecessary detour into making him the next level of creepy in a very kind of, like, cheap and easy way. And it really, I think, takes her character out of the knees.
I found it symptomatic that the movie couldn't actually include the scene where it happens, because we find out later.
Yeah.
Like, we get a short line of dialogue that characterizes what the rest of that night was like. And it did seem so dissonant with the choices both of those actors were making about their characters and that the costumers were making. I mean, Jake Gyllenhaal just doesn't even look like he's playing somebody whose big agenda is sex. But in the way that Nightcrawler is constantly going back and forth between, I thought, trying to really put over this scenario in heightened but plausible terms, and in other moments is just trying to play around with concepts and provoke you at that level. And
I just feel like that kind of particular turn plays so much better as subtext than text.
Yeah.
And it bumps me out that they made it text.
I hear what you guys are saying there too, but I actually think that the fact that the scene wasn't there helps it straddle that line much better than you're saying.
Oh, I think it would have been a disaster to have it in it. I just found it revealing that if you actually showed us that scene, the falsity of the turn would have just been exposed. And it seemed like they had built themselves up to a plot twist that was so precarious that they couldn't actually deliver it.
Yeah.
Right.
Of course, for all we know, they're just like, oh, nobody wants to see a 40-year-old lady have sex. Yucky. But
well, the director is married to Rene Russo, so you can at least take that out of the running, probably.
I really hope this leads to her getting cast in a lot of different things again, because she's... I didn't realize how much I had missed seeing her on screen. I never really thought of her as, like, a favorite of mine.
Yeah.
But
everyone seems to forget she was in Thor, you guys. Crucial role in Thor.
Well, speaking of actors not being challenged.
Up Thor as much as me, but still.
Listen, they got to build a great house with that Thor money.
Good for them. I was in a very get it bitch mood with her with this movie where I was just like, yes, Rene Russo, like absolutely take all of it down. But then ultimately I think the movie just grows disinterested with her and becomes so much more about bug-eyed Gyllenhaal.
All right, well, that's all the time we have. Any last words from anyone?
I'm going to be in get it bitch mode for so many people now that Joe has given me the idea. Who else can I be pulling for now?
As far as legacies go, I'll take it.